This is Nancy Qualls Corbett. April 11th, 1992. The Matter with the Feminine. Tape 1 of 2.
Saturday, April 11th. Nancy Qualls Corbett. Workshop, The Matter with the Feminine. 1992.
A week that I was in the desert with a group of 120 women, and Bev was one, and I was one of those 120. And I was there as one of the four staff people. And afterwards, when we were recapping about what we liked that happened and what we didn't like that happened and how would we like to change things and so forth, then it came to me, I said, whereas that we talked a great deal about the feminine and the feminine archetypes and the goddesses and so forth, and really reached that part of our feminine energy, what we did not talk about with the women is our masculine side. And I said, maybe if we have another one, that part should also be included. Well, then that was in Arizona, and I came back to Birmingham, and I had a dream that night. And what I wanted to tell you was this dream that I had. And it was that I was back in Arizona and still with the women's group. And there we, in actuality, had a big white tent which we worked in and did a lot of our, all of our work in, actually, 5 days. And it was, in the dream, there was a sense of urgency that we were to do some type of presentation at 5 o'clock. But the urgency was we couldn't wait till 5 o'clock. We had to do it at 3 o'clock. And we had to do it because we had to reach the Japanese women and because we had to reach the men. And then the next part of the dream was that I was there in the big tent and I was working. And I was working with a man. And and I was standing behind him, and what I was doing, because this man had kind of like pictures that we see of thalidomide babies, his arms were off right here, and at the end of his arms there were these little nubs of fingers, he's just kind of sticking down there. And what I was doing was working with this man, and my arms around his, I was standing in the back of him, my arms around his waist, and I was taking the little nubs of the finger, and we had clay we were working with, and I was helping him to form that clay into a little clay pot, to make a little clay pot. And I never did get to the Japanese women in the dream. But I wanted to know that this is, I think, in part what we want to be working on today, even though I wrote that we were going to be working on the matter of the feminine about a year ago. But I didn't know how I was really going to be working on the matter of the feminine. This is matter, our clay. Our being, what we are. And of course the clay pot is the receptacle or the sense of the container. The container, all the feminine image is always symbolized by some type of container. Now, so when working with that dream, I didn't want at all to imply that men, or the male gender, were the crippled ones, that women and their whole intermale unconscious side are crippled because it's not allowing that animus image to help them form their own sense of their feminine nature, you see. And so, and then of course with men too, in our collective conscious attitude with the male population, how do they respond to the feminine and the feminine nature in them? So it's equally important for men and women. Well, while we talk this morning, what I ask you to do, if you don't mind getting your hands red and clay under your fingernails, is while we're talking, we each one get a whole lump of clay, and we're just going to be feeling it and letting this texture, letting us understand what matter is, you see, how this relates to the body and substance that we were talking about last night. So what we'll do is just take a little time now and get our wad of clay, and we're all going to be sitting here. Can I knead your clay? And instead of trying to let your ego shape this vessel, the pot, of letting the clay tell you when it's time to be formed. Seeing if you can let it respond to you. And then begin to shape it as it wants to be shaped. Somebody said it was probably Dr. Jung, but I don't know where it could be. Something like, nature is divine, and we must live in accord with it. Not, we think of it in other terms, that it's to live in accord with us. So let's see if we can let the pot shape what it wants to be, and as if we live in accord with the clay. Last night when we were talking, if you recall, someone asked the questions about how that our response to our own body or our denial of our own body, certainly our instinctive life, that we see that in the physical nature of the earth also. And it truly is that. And we want to keep this in mind when we're talking about not only our personal body, our personal matter, but matter, mother, the same thing, a root. See that we always are in accord with that. And if we think how, you know, our sky covering being destroyed, our sea life is being destroyed, certainly animal and plant life is deteriorating. Children suffering physical abuse, emotional abuse. We just don't have really a whole lot to hang on to now. So we're making a real point for understanding what is the matter. What is the matter with the feminine? And seeing how, if we can begin to explore, in one sense, what is the matter, or what's happening to the feminine, and also think of ways in which we can begin to redeem it. Again, both sides, personally and also in our collective world. A middle-aged man dreams this. a white cat, which is really a person, with a great deal of animosity, crawls on my lap or in my bed. This was causing me physical pain to have the cat around. I didn't feel guilty, but I felt her revenge on me. I had something to do with the death of its kitten. That was the end of the dream. I didn't feel guilty, but I felt its revenge on me. It's really a person, yeah. Okay. This is another man's dream, a businessman. I'm with my mother in church. We arrive early and sit in the choir on the right side from the entrance, but left of the preacher. We cannot see. Now the sermon is over and my family leaves without me. I have to wait. My brother is also in church with his girlfriends. One is very vulgar, with no pants, and has her hands at her sex. Her sex has been slashed. Both men's... that's the end of the dream. Her sex has been slashed. This is a European man's dream, and this is his wordings. So, what we see from both of these men's dreams... find that the new life has been killed off, or that of the feminine, which really depicts the sexual aspect of the feminine, has been slashed, cut, degraded, because it doesn't fit in with the sense of the feminine in the spirituality, or mother. I'm with my mother in church, you see. So we're looking at a different type of the feminine, but not one in that's really in accord with how men wants to structure the feminine, either being mother type or being very spiritual in church type. I was telling a few of you, I woke at Alabama time this morning, which was 6 o'clock, and watched a movie on TV. And the movie was Ramblin' Rose. Has anyone seen it? Okay. And this image of this woman, we'll just kind of talk about her, those that have seen the film, is just really pertinent. If you haven't seen it, find it, because it's really pertinent to what we're talking about. It is a film about it's in the South. I don't know why they always depict women in sexy things happening in the South, but they do. Maybe that's it. But this is kind of depicted as this poor farm girl comes to live with this southern well-to-do family, and to be kind of a housekeeper, nanny person, and she's being saved from these the big city at Birmingham, actually. Because the men there didn't say so explicitly, but they were using her. She was a whore. And, she comes to live with this family, and she's very provocative, and she dresses provocatively, and when she walks to town, she swings her hips, and she picks up all sorts of kind of men, and she's different. She's real different. Of course, the father in the film doesn't know what to do about all this. And there's a 13-year-old son, and he is amazed. Lots transpires between those two. She teaches him a whole lot. At one point, then there is a time in which she has the Rose has, and Rose is a good person. She maybe one would call kind of simple. How would you describe her? The ones that have seen her, innocent, yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
Yeah. Is she
made in life?
Is she what? Is she made
in life? No. Not in the sense of needing to... well, I don't know how to explain that. Not in the sense of feeling like she's a little girlish. No, she likes her body.
When I think of Megan, not quite awakened.
Okay. She likes her body. She's not conscious of her womanhood. Maybe that would be another way to explain it. Yeah. And she likes men, and she likes sex. And so at one point she has she's in the hospital with pneumonia, and the doctor falls is very stricken by her charms, and it alludes to in the film that he has visits her at home, just not for house calls. It kind of gives you that idea. There's another time in which Rose thinks she's pregnant, but it comes out that she has some kind of tumor. What the doctor and the husband, because they are both so fascinated by Rose and Rose's sexuality, and they don't know what to do with it within themselves, they kind of collude to what they will do is to do a total hysterectomy and take out Rose's ovaries and everything, so she won't be have any sexual feelings. You see, now this is what we're kind of talking about in the sense of how man destroys the feminine in order that he doesn't have to deal with those feelings in himself. Pardon? No. Yeah, he was trying to be understanding, and yet at the same time you could feel the father's dilemma, because he says, "I have growing children in this house, and what am I doing with this Rose? And all these men are climbing in her window, or whatever you see," and you can hear his dilemma, and yet. You hear the kids talking, and they know exactly what's going on. I mean, they don't have any problem with it. Father has a problem with it. There is a wonderful character in there who is the mother. And she, you know, she brings it right out in the open. You know, look what you men are doing. And she has a real deep understanding that, you know, this is what this creature was created to be. So she really, the film is set somewhere in the 30s, so you're getting this, you know, some old kind of ideas coming out. Right.
I was skating from 7 to 8. I always skated at the time. And I struggled. got up this morning and called my school, and I don't want to do it because it's too late.
Oh!
Yes, and I read all these books when this was happening, and all the women who were in class. Here in this country, all the women who go to the It's not like that, but it doesn't mean that people are just nothing. Doctors, I remember that I went in because I was having trouble sleeping, and the fact that I was going through a separation and a loss of marriage, went right past the doctor. He just said, hormones. You know, I asked myself, okay, why? And he said, and he gave me this whole list of things, you know, that, and I kept counting for normal. But the only thing that I was willing to do was I was having some breast pain, and I asked if it was a possibility that okay, hormonal changes were causing that. And so I was willing to try it. I only tried it for 6 weeks. I took myself off of them because they did everything that he told me they would cure me of that I wasn't experiencing. They created the symptoms. And I went off of them too, and likewise, because the breast pain really was there. It was a real physical thing. There was a tumor there.
Mm-hmm.
But that had not been detected. And so, but I asked too, the other thing, I said, all right, how long do you want these things? He said, oh, today we're putting women on them until they're 7 years old or more. And I said, no. But again, I really have to take charge of your own life, and I am dealing with women's positions now.
And this is something about, and he said, well, what if you have your uterus removed? They don't have to worry about it. That was a very common for his wife to be.
That's sad, yeah. Okay, well, these are things, and you all know where you live, these things of how the reaction to the feminine, the reaction to the sense of the body, to matter, so really looking at, I think, is the ethos of our culture and our apparent values that we're seeing this kind of backlash happening. The values of life which have prevailed and endured through our civilizations have been oriented toward the patriarchy. And so, and when we talk about the patriarchy, I don't mean that those things that have been ruled by man, person, gender, but the rules that have been laid down by the logos principle, or the thinking, the rational aspect, which has no sense of the feminine, which is more related to the relational and the feeling tones, see. Now, probably the most universal symbol that we do have for the masculine in our is the tower. And we can see the tower of our the church steeple of our religious institutions. Are the tower, the ivory towered of our educational systems. Are the Sears tower of our commerce situations, you see. So I want you to hear through all of this how we're governed by these, or how we kind of know what these towers are about, you see. They're this kind of memorial to this one, not a memorial, they're this because they're still living, but this kind of, you know, they keep us always reminded of this, that this kind of phallic image that's there right in front of us. So what I want to do is talk about this fairy story called Maid Maleen that has to do with a tower. And if we think about this tower being kind of a patriarchal culture. Actually, what I'm going to do is, because I'm going to do, what's it called? A hybrid, when two things are joined together to make another one. I'm going to do a hybrid fairy story. It begins with Maid Maleen, and because Maid Maleen's ending just kind of goes on and on and on till it finally gets there, there's another ending, which is the ending really the same, but it gets there much quicker and much easier to understand. And I'll tell you where I switch fairy tales, and the ending is King Thrushbeard, which is another Grimm's fairy story. The first one is Maid Maleen, and then the ending that I've put on it is King Thrushbeard. Actually, they fit in so well. Actually, I was doing a talk and using this some things in here as an example, and I had was writing at my computer and didn't think a thing about it, and then I got to the speech and was reading it, and I thought, this isn't Maid Maleen's ending, you know, this is King Thrushbeard, but it just fit in. So anyway, I liked it, so I thought, well, this tells exactly what we're going to do. So what we need to do is, in hearing a fairy tale, sometimes it's easier to get the images if we just close your eyes and kind of relax into the fairy tale. So kind of pay attention to the imagery and then begin to think in terms of these things about the what we said about the patriarchy, and we'll kind of follow it from there. Pardon? Thrushbeard, King Thrushbeard. In the fairy tale, it explains that the king came as a beggar to marry the king's daughter. This man who was a beggar came. He had a funny little beard that was kind of crooked at the end. And because the princess was so haughty, she put down every man who came, she says, "Oh, his beard looks like a thrush." So that's where the name King Thrushbeard came from.
Gray beard,
bristle
beard,
the whole series. Yeah, they use beards a lot.
All these children.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the beard symbol?
Oh, it can be a lot. Usually when we think of it, because of it's the hair that's formed around the mouth, and it's the masculine hair that's formed around the mouth, that it usually has a lot to do in a woman for the animus. She speaks out of the animus mouth rather than her own mouth. It's not hard to do if the animus is too strong. You know, it comes on before we know it. But here in the masculine psychology, it's usually a sense of virility too. So anyway, we really won't be dealing too much with the beard. So if you want to just kind of close your eyes and get into kind of getting into the sense of the fairy tale. I'll tell you a fairy tale. So this story tells of a young woman, a princess, who wished, was very, very much in love with the most handsome prince from a different country. And she wished to marry him because he loved her very much. The prince's father, the king, said, oh no, she couldn't marry this prince because he could not benefit her land, his land. He could not bring any real benefits to the kingdom. So why should she marry him? She should marry someone of the king's choice. And of course the young princess was very, very upset and very, very sad. But because he was frightened that she might run off or whatever, he built a tower without any windows, and he sealed the princess and her handmaiden in there for 7 years until she came to her senses, he said. There was ample supplies installed in the tower to sustain them, she and her handmaiden. And so for 7 years they sat in the still darkness. And nearing the end of this time, they became aware of it because the supplies were depleted, or about to be depleted. And they became very anxious that no one was coming to release them. And they were still sealed in a tower which might become their tomb. So each day they grew more and more fearful. But in a way, it was this apprehension that provoked them to move. With a bread knife, they ever so slowly gouged the mortar in the stone wall. And then it was that they could finally remove one stone. And they looked out and they saw the clear sky. So finally, with much persistent work, they were able to make the hole large enough to crawl through. When they reached the ground outside and looked around, to their astonishment, the whole kingdom had been ravaged. Nothing was left. No food, no shelter, nor people. The kingdom of the father had been demolished. She could not return to the world of being the princess as she had once known. So again the princess and her handmaiden were forlorn. What would become of them now? Who would protect, shelter, and feed them? Realizing they had no other resources, they relied on their own ingenuity. They set out to find another kingdom. And as they crossed the barren land with much difficulty, they had only nettles to eat. The land was so wasted that it could support no trees for shady respite or luscious sweet food, only prickly and stinging nettles. Still they continued on until they did reach another kingdom. And in order to support themselves, the princess and the handmaiden now no longer a handmaiden but a true companion. Both of them found work in this new place, in the new kingdom's kitchen, in the palace kitchen. And they scoured the floors, and they washed the windows, and they acted as scullery maids, jobs that were certainly demeaning their status. But they learned to do them very well, and they did them well. Now, this is where it changes over to the hovel. And one night at the palace, there was a gay celebration with feasting and dancing. The princess, feeling so deprived, stowed a little chicken leg and stuck it in her pocket. And then the dancing started. There was wonderful music, and the ballroom was lit up with thousands of candles. Beautiful people dancing round and round. And the old princess, new scullery maid, could hardly stand it. She heard the music. She had to peek in, and she saw these wonderful people dancing. She became so enchanted with seeing them that she was standing there in the middle of the door just watching what was happening. And the prince spied her. The prince of this kingdom spied her and said, "You must come and dance." And she said, "Oh no, I could never do that. I could never do that. My tattered clothes and my ratty hair and my work-reddened hands." She was just too embarrassed to be seen by these glorious, beautiful people. But he insisted, and she was led to the dance floor. And she began to enjoy herself, and she twirled around and danced and listened to the music and moved with it. And as she twirled around, the chicken leg fell out of her pocket, slung across the floor. Everything stopped. The music stopped. The people stopped. All eyes in the whole grand ballroom were on the chicken leg. It's just absolutely mortifying. And then she looked into the laughing eyes of the prince and realized that he was her same true love. She had, after the years of abandonment and isolation, a perilous journey, after hard years of tedious work, and the last thread of humiliation, she finally arrived at her place, her new kingdom. Now stay with those images just for a while. You know, just open your eyes and put your fingers in the clay. Imagine yourself sealed in a tower. What is your tower like? What is it made of? How is it constructed? Or have a name. Button right now. Keep these images very alive. We'll do the rest of it later on this afternoon, but I want just to hold this idea very close to you. So when you're ready, just kind of put your, know that your feet are on the ground and bring yourself back to this room. Specifically, if you choose, what were your thoughts, your images? Kind of what? How'd you feel about that princess being locked up, sealed up in a tower? What were some of the reactions that your body told you about, and then some of the reactions that your head told you about? You come.
Familiar.
I'm living this story. I just emerged from that. And I was aware last September that I'd be coming out at the beginning of the year. And I'm in a rich man's home that's asked the cook now. And I know it's for a reason, and I'm present with what I'm doing. And now the dance has to begin for the prince. But I feel comfortable with what's evolving in the fairy tale, because I'm beginning to understand. While I was in the tower, I was asking and praying for understanding, and that was the handmaiden that is with me, and slowly but surely the understanding is coming of what's been happening. Mm-hmm. I think my two fathers, my relationship with outer men and my own masculine, put me in the tower, and I've been widowed since I knew him. And I come out and I have no relationship with any of the men that I went in knowing. It's like they're all broken and wounded. And I've sort of been going over that because I care for my brother and my father. And it's that I went back to contact them. No one is able to speak or talk. And I realized that it just is that way. There's no pain in that. It's more understanding. So I felt very familiar with the story without pain. It's like there's more to come. I could not. So that's really
true. When I came out of the tower, I realized that the thing that I knew was the grass and the earth, the dust and the water, the flowers, it's like nature, it's lost nature.
my tower, it's just really thin window. I mean, you can see a little bit to the sky. It was like I was so closed off from nature. It was really horrible. Huh. And I wanted to kiss the ground.
Closed off from nature was the real feeling of what this talent was about for you.
That's one of the reasons I felt comfortable in the tower. My tower was very tall, and they had like a Chinese cap over the top. Enough underneath were just little tiny openings, so when I stood on my tiptoes, I could see downward, and I could see the earth, I could see the grass. I could not see the sky. And so when I came out, the sky was really important to me, that it was all together, the sky joined here.
I saw when I came out, I too missed nature, that there was a plague that was now on the earth that wasn't there when I went in. I associated that with the AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the tower, I realized I was in the tower. I had no idea how I got done. I was just there. I wasn't alone. I was with a man and my dog and a child. And I don't think the child was very anything. I got out because there were too many people. I got out with a spoon.
What is that?
A spoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any realization of what it looked like or anything because I couldn't see the outside of the tower, but when I got out, things were different. I realized that I didn't have to live with lists and things I had to do. I could be at rest in the sun. And then I think I was beginning to realize how I got in the tower only after I got in.
I see. While you were in the tower, there was no clue of how you got in the tower. It was only when you got out and looking at retrospectively. Huh? Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting.
Walking around all the things. It's very interesting because I just said 2 days ago I had a dream that I was moving to my house. And me and my children were moving. Everybody with a box and everything was moving away. And I was told there were big changes. And I got very scared that I had a way of telling you know what this was going to be. But when I heard the tower, I just knew that I was in the tower, you know, and I saw the tower. It was very small, the chamber of the tower. It was built out of concrete. It had one tiny window, and I could only see the sky from the window. And when I went to the lane, it came to me, Bombas, and there was a name of the tower. And then I had to think who put me there. I thought that I put myself where it was necessary for me to be there. And I was there for a long, long time. And what I had in the tower was my poetry and my cat. And to go out, I used the little pocket knife that I had. Somehow scratch up, kind of manipulate the lock on the door of the tower so I can get out. I went out, there was this beautiful, I saw trees. There were lots of trees and a big black bear, but I wasn't scared of them actually. And there was a cherry tree, and there were white blossoms. But I felt a little frightened and a little shy to be out. Tower all alone without anyone suddenly kind of feeling free. And I stood there, I just didn't even know exactly what to do.
They're feeling the pressure here, huh? Your tower was made of concrete, you said. Anybody else? No. Stones, huh? Yes, stones.
Stones, because of a break of your My tower was actually very, almost like a museum, you know, nice new king towers, beautiful walls, and but this empty room, and in the tower with me, to my very surprise, was my mother. And this is when I wanted to get out. I thought this is not, I mean, even though it was a nice place, I did not feel right to be stuck in there with my mother. And the name of the tower was something like the Tower of Rejection, or Unforgiveness. And so I wanted, it felt like I wanted an ally, like when he said, who else would you want in the tower with you? So I wanted my friend Valerie with me, because she would be very impatient in a situation like this, being stuck, you know, and she would come up with, not necessarily have the idea how to get out, but she would have the energy to get me moving. And then I thought, okay, how am I going to get out? And what I did first is I just sort of expanded the walls. Just felt like it's my energy. I thought, well, this is not going to get me out. It's just going to make the room larger. So it took an explosion. And then when I was out, I was like on the top of the mountain. I was like in the sky, being in the scattered valley, and just looking over the water. And it was the connection with nature. And just felt, you know, hearing the wind and the colors. And mm-hmm. But it took an explosion.
First, when I was thinking about the tower of the person in the story, the woman and the women, I couldn't accept that there was no light, and I was redesigning the tower in my mind so that at least there would be a straight tower, but there would be a smaller roof on top so that they could see up to the sky. And then I was thinking about that aspect of towers, which is not simply the masculine, but also the reaching for the sky. A lot of towers have been with the spiritual search for God, I thought, well, if you're just looking at the sky, it's so, it can get you so unbalanced, just that energy, but they wouldn't be permitted to see the earth. And then when I got into my own tower, I just had with me a mouse and a grasshopper, and it I didn't want any people with me. And the object that I imagined was a great big book. And the way I got out was to take a big timber, and first I was going to set it crossways and have it explode so that it would burst the sides. But that seemed a bit unrealistic. So eventually I had a rope and suspended it and used it as a battering ram to break the wall and then climb down. When I got out, there were no people either. I had my little animal insect friends, but it was like an 18th century English countryside.
So it was lush and...
A pastoral, yeah.
Uh-huh. With clipped hedges and...
No, just rolling meadows.
Oh, I see. No, okay.
I can't
there. Okay.
But I was intrigued that there were no people.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of mine does refer to my apartment as my ivory tower.
Have a sense of power. I was trying to get to that image with my own.
Your own.
Stuff was coming. It was just very dark. And then when you said come out, I felt like a plant that's had something sitting on it too long, you know, in the spring or the summertime, when you finally lift that old shingle or board or something, and it was just yellow. But it had grown. And it was waiting for the sun, you know. But it had begun to sprout anyway. In spite of not having any light, it had germinated and it was just waiting for the light to green it up, you know, and grow some more. But there was no tower, it was just dark.
I found it interesting what you said earlier about your tower, because it seems that a tower doesn't necessarily have to be in a negative situation. It seems that at times in our lives, we just want to be contained and secluded. Mm-hmm. And the way she talked about it is...
The thing that was important to me about my tower is that I was sealed in it. I don't know why. I was in it by myself. Mm-hmm. I went in willingly, and I was sealed in. When I was ready to come out, the tower was sealed. It just... And the other thing that's real important for me is that I can go back to that tower, but now I have control of it.
I have a similar experience with my wife's tower also. And it seemed that I needed to go in the tower because I was too involved with the female part of myself and I needed to have that ominous connection. And so being in there was that experience of becoming. So when it was time for it to go out, it was not very much. And the kitchen seemed particularly significant to me because a kitchen is a kind of place of alchemical changes. So then from being in this tower and having that experience of the masculine, that it was not going to the kitchen. And see what changes did we make. Then coming out of the kitchen, I couldn't get that chicken back. It's almost as though in order to make a change, you need some symbolic thing. And that maybe the chicken bone didn't have any more significance than just the object of transformation. But that meant that story.
Yeah.
It was a good experience.
Yeah. It was a good experience. You felt the...
I guess in my situation, living in someone's home, I can relate to the word you used with the chicken bone, is that she had a deprivation. And I would see where I too had to come with terms of deprivation being in someone's home, that I wasn't able to walk out and have my own home, and yet I like walked to the other side of the tree and saw it from another perspective, that whatever is growing within me has a safe place. So, but yeah. I can. Without thinking, she just put the chicken leg in her pocket. I guess I can react to that. I take a cookie out of the pantry.
Yeah.
Where did the fairy tale, one fairy tale, break off with another kid when she got out of the tower?
No, when actually in both fairy tales that she wanders to this new kingdom and she starts working as a scullery maid. And it's at that point when she gets the chicken leg and does the dance that it begins to change to the other one.
It seems to me it's significant too that when the chicken leg falls out, everybody is very embarrassing situation. Mm-hmm. The prince laughs. It's like you don't get a day anymore. You have a collective judgment, you know?
Or the sense that as if that she could not remain the princess. I mean, she had gone through everything that she could have possibly go through. And it was then that she could see the prince for who he was, not because she was a princess. And she deserved that, you see. It's kind of what talking about earlier about the maiden, you see, of where one begins to accept the responsibility of the womanhood and all that that, you know, and all that that entails. Any other comments?
Have you had a book, St. Barbara and the Tower?
Yeah.
That was several years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So coming out of the tower at that point, it would have been a struggle to escape and come out to a devastated landscape. But in the imagery today, it felt suffocating and confining, but, you know, and I think it's very positive, honest, it's helping me. And you're able just to remove the stones when the time is right and walk out and look into the landscape like you described. Sun, okay. Lush,
yeah.
Green countryside, very... It felt so good just to stand tall in the sun.
Mm-hmm. So, was the tower confining for you in a way?
In a way, but not the pain that it was. You know, you read that book and sort of
familiar. Yeah.
Felt really good.
Uh-huh.
Helpful.
Yeah.
The other thing that occurred at the same time is like, as far as the stress students were something was digging, and I had some, and I couldn't conceive of what kind of animal. But something just had this sense of this motion, like a mole or like when a dog digs, and just very rapid kind of movements that get underneath something. It was a sense of descending or going, getting out by going under, and I had a sense of that. And that
but it was tunneling out, instead of knocking the wall down.
Mm-hmm. Go
under the earth.
Into past the foundation, down. It seemed like the taller the tower, the deeper the foundation, and the deeper you had to go.
Actually, I bought my tower in the edge of the tower. You know, I just bought it everywhere. I just didn't want to be there. It was just years and years and years. It was so unbearable. But I couldn't get out. No matter what I did, I just couldn't get out. There's no way. So I just sit there like a fall tree. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now, seems like this to me a little bit synchronistic with the dream. But now it's time probably to stick my head out a little bit and see what mm-hmm. the world looks like.
First hall was very dark.
Cold.
Yeah. And I was made of stone, but I couldn't see the stone. I just knew it. And although I was alone, I had a
real deep sense that my father was there. A sort of looming over, sort of an interjected father part. And some, I'm not sure how I got out. I just somehow got out. And I had this feeling of discovery. It's like this other world that I didn't know existed and that I wanted to go out and explore. And there's a sense of just extreme excitement. You know, I didn't see people, but I sensed that there were people were all around and there was hustling and bustling and, you know, just things that I needed to go out and find for myself. So it was a very pleasant day.
Hey.
I have a question yesterday, the undoctored version. But the tower was only about 6 feet across. And it was very tall, very dark. And that's how it seemed today, and it seemed okay. The cat was there. And I was thinking about this notion of provisions for 7 years. And for some reason, I started thinking about fish. Which is probably
about what?
About fish.
Fish?
Yeah. And the next thing I knew, the time was up. I mean, I really just made a gap. Like, I had paints in the tower for 2 days, and acrylics. And then I was out and found that the tower was in a high mountain cirque by a little lake, a small lake, all surrounded, really ringed by mountains. The air was beautiful. It's very clean. And I was particularly concerned about getting out or being alone there. The cat and I were just there.
Mm-hmm.
The gaps sort of bother me because those are things I don't want to feel. I don't know how I got out of the tower. But anyway, the fish was sort of interesting. I'm not sure what it was. It's just there.
Yeah. I was really surprised because when you first started talking, being in the tower, it was very dark. I noticed that there was a young, very young girl, maybe 7 years old with me. And I was starting to imagine, well, this is a dark tower and it's hard and everything. And I noticed that it wasn't. And my first impression was, well, it's water. The walls were water. And then I noticed that they were thicker than just water. And I was just really struck by that. And then when you start talking about getting, you know, it's an instrument to get out of the tower, right? Well, of course, a bucket, you know? So I went through the walls, and of course, the bucket wasn't going to work because it, you know, you couldn't bucket.
Uh-huh.
And so I noticed that we could just push our hands kind of through the walls, and as we did, the walls got light. You could almost see the light coming through. And then I really noticed that it was a clear liquid almost. I mean, as I pushed through the walls would get light, but then when I pulled back, it would get dark. I don't know why, but I decided, and it was a little bit of fear of getting out of the wall. It's just, my impression was that there was something that I was going to have to be responsible for when I went through that wall.
So I
just chose to, you know, push almost through it and see if there was a landscape out there, but then we'd pull back. That's where I stayed. Yeah, liquid walls. That took me a
little
surprise.
Liquid walls, yeah.
I would have thought, you know, hard, choosing through.
Yeah. Did the little 7-year-old girl come out with you? Or?
Yeah, she was right there with me.
She was right there.
Yeah, and we were both very sad. We were first in there, and as we became more entranced with the walls and just that, this, they're not hard, what is this? We became more involved in that. So, yeah, we were both right together, pushing through there, and going, what the hell is this?
Uh-huh.
It was eerie, too.
Yeah. I feel like you need to get a wetsuit and a scuba gear and whatever.
It wasn't gooey.
It
didn't stick. It was good. It was good.
Huh?
father had put me there, and it was called What is Reality? And I had my cats there, and I was really comfortable. I had no particular desires to go out, except when I looked out the one window, I could see my husband below. Everything else down below was blurry. I could see that it was Earth. But I couldn't see individual people or anything else. I could sense that the world was out there. And one day in the basket, which was attached on a rope, there was a walkie-talkie. And somehow I took that as a sign that I could come out, so I loaded the cats and myself in the basket and lowered myself down. And joined my husband, and there were a lot of, there was kind of a Garden of Eden type thing, only there were a lot of people there, and everyone, all the families, were walking and talking. And it's interesting, I've been working with the Tower Image for a while now, and we synchronistically bought walkie-talkies of all of them. And it was my idea, and now I realize that, I mean, I realized for a long time that what I crave in relationship is more true communication. And I didn't realize when I bought the walkie-talkies that that was one of the things that, you know, it was like a little toy for a specific reason. Sort of got, oh, of course. Great, and I like the Tower a lot. And there's a lot of me that could just be there uncomplicatedly for a long time. And there's that other part that wants to kind of rejoin.
I think several of you said that you did have a door that you could go in and out of your tower. Did anyone get out and see what was there and immediately crawl back in? Actually, we do that a lot. But when we think about this very secure place, even though it does imprison us, it from the harsh reality, sometimes it's more comfortable to be in. What was your tower again? If this is reality, what was the name
of
it?
What is reality?
What is reality, yeah. So sometimes our towers protect us against having to look at what reality is about. Tell me about your merchant ships again.
And we'd get to a some fascinating port, you know, Yokohama or Saigon or something like that. And I'd ask some of the old guys, are you going ashore? And sometimes the old response, there's nothing out there.
There's nothing out there.
Well, it's beyond sadness. Beyond sadness. It's just that it's the wall. They're living the wall. They're determined to be inside. That was. It was very.
That's very sad. I mean, you feel it deep, yeah. Deep.
Stayed with me about a year.
Yeah, I've seen that.
My son has a game, a board game called Heroes Quest, and the heroes, kids, they're four heroes, a barbarian, a wizard, a dwarf, and an elf, and some of them can cast these different spells against the monsters that are in this, you know, spread of game. And one of the spells allows them to pass through walls unless there's some boundary that's given
with each flag that is set up, there are finite pieces to this maze. And so if there's a final boundary, instead of being able to pass through the wall, the girl becomes embedded in the stone and can't get out. And they can cast that spell, but until they attempt it, they don't know what's on the other side. Whether they can do the wall or pass through it.
Oh. So if you pass in and become part of the stone wall, the game's over.
That girl can lose its part of the wall. There's there isn't a spell to undo that spell. You know? And so that girl becomes embedded for that level of the quest. It goes like 50 different quests.
That's nice,
and different maps for each level. What's the name? It's called Hero's Quest. It's a similar thing to Dungeons and Dragons, which I'm not as well acquainted with. The boys will sit around and do this.
You know? Okay.
My son, my mom, you know. Do this.
Now you might be more inclined to play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, but it's just that there are no women in this particular game. It's four masculine figures and the monsters.
Guess who the women are? But I think that imagery, though, of where we do become that stone wall that imprisons us. Yeah. Or it might not be stone, but we become that which imprisons us.
Our spell is turned against ourselves.
Yeah.
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 The spell we've cast.
Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of the heart of the giant where the older brothers go out and get turned into stone, and there's a whole garden of stone sculptures. You know, these attempts to break through, they always turn into stone. I feel like I've done that in my life, turned to stone quite a few times.
Yeah.
Gone through a long period of time, not knowing, fall, and I wake up, and the younger brother comes, and finally, hopefully, I've made it to the depths that goes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, exactly that. But I just kind of like to, these are the personal reactions to our towers. And I think some made some kind of collective responses to the tower, or at least getting out of seeing the ravages. We're going to put it on a more externalized collective place now. You know, we made references to our economic situations. Does anyone want to kind of project into that some more? What's happening to the feminine? Or the sense of the feminine? And I'm talking about this sense of relatedness, of caring, of the sense of bridging, sense of mediating. You know, if we're cut off from that, if that aspect of our world has been caught in a tower. Yeah.
I just thought of something. I do it in the diamond, and it's a very rural, it's not rural because there's these big wealthy homes, but two of the homes have towers on these estates. And I, as you were starting to talk, I thought how much wealth it costs to build a tower because they're wooden towers and they look like they were used for someone to go meditate or do writing. They're very tall, maybe two stories high, and they're beautiful. They're as big as this room, this circumference. They're on these big estates, and they're fascinating looking after knowing the symbolism of the time.
Are they new homes?
No, they're old estates. They're very old. They look like they were built in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
They're exquisite. I mean,
mm-hmm.
The child in me wants to sneak in to explore and be wonderful. But it's a whole different feeling than the stone. It's like a gift to the process.
I see.
I'm intrigued with know, so many of the stories, there's a masculine figure that comes to help the feminine out of the tower. But in this case, the masculine figures are gone. And so it's the feminine that brings herself out. And so I just wonder how that relates to the present. You know, will there be any real help from the masculine today for what we retake the presence and recreate the presence of the feminine in the world?
Now, I would have questioned, you know, whether that, yeah, I think the two are there to work together, the masculine and the feminine, until I had my dream about the man with the little mite arms. And that was just a couple of weeks ago. And it that really did surprise me, because I thought, this, you know, there's, if that's the masculine principle, he can't grasp. He has no hands to grasp. He has no arms to embrace, you see. So we are kind of, we really are crippled there.
Well, the masculine today is, it seems to me, is weighted on the side of continuing the destruction. Much talk
Thank you.
of the awareness of what the body can store. I mean, in a pregnancy, often the more nauseated the woman is in the first few months, the better the implantation, the stronger the embryo. One of the first signs of a miscarriage is a loss of that feeling of queasiness. And the discomforts that the breasts aren't tender anymore. There's not this feeling. I mean, all those things change. And so, in addition to that, there's the awareness, there's the consciousness of what it means to conceive, or what it means, what the feminine means for one of all.
It slows you down. Cares you to take on.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.